Making a Better America. It's a pleasure to introduce this afternoon Dr. Thor Hogan, who will speak to us on energy, climate, and the future of American security, picking up some of the themes from this morning's session. Dr. Hogan is a professor, writer, and a pragmatic progressive. Thor Hogan is an associate professor of politics and environmental sustainability at Earlham College in Indiana, where his research focuses on science and technology policy, primarily examining climate and energy policy in the context of American politics. He's the author of Hydrocarbon Nation: How Energy Security Made Our Nation Great and Climate Security Will Save Us. Also, the book, The View from Space, NASA's Evolving Struggle to Understand Our Home Planet, co-authored with Richard Leshner. And Mars Wars, The Rise and Fall of the Space Exploration Initiative. He's also a regular contributor to the Washington Post, where he writes on topics ranging from American politics to environmental policy to American foreign policy. He was formerly director of the Space Policy Project at the RAND Corporation's Science and Technology Policy Institute and deputy communications director for the Massachusetts Democratic Party. Dr. Hogan.
Well, thanks so much, Richard. And thank you to you and all of the other organizers of the conference for doing such an incredible job and so much work bringing this all together and really keeping it alive during these troubling times over the last year and a half. And thanks so much for inviting me to participate. I really appreciate it. As Richard suggested, my background is in both the think tank world and as an academic. And as a result of that, I have a tendency to use PowerPoint slides. And so an occupational hazard, I guess. And so I'm actually going to share a screen so that as I go through my talk, that people have some sort of visual cues of the things that I'm going to be talking about. And so let me see if I can do this. I'm not sure. Not sure if I'm being successful in that, so I might go forward without them.
Is your PowerPoint open?
Yeah, it is.
Usually it's good to open it before you do share screen.
Yeah, no, it's open. So I think maybe I'm just going to move forward without it. All right, so we'll do that. As Richard suggested, the ideas in my talk today are going to be largely drawn from a book I wrote a few years ago entitled Hydrocarbon Nation: How Energy Security Made Us Great and Climate Security Will Save Us. The book really started as an examination of the impact of hydrocarbons on American political history. And I was mainly interested in understanding why we hadn't taken the climate crisis more seriously. But that study eventually turned into something a little bit deeper and turned into kind of an exploration of the fundamental weaknesses of our constitutional system. And so I'm going to talk about that today. So my plan for today is to sort of talk through a quick overview of the historical connection that I found between energy and politics in our country, continue with how I think that helps explain the political challenges that our nation is faced with today, and conclude with a discussion of some potential paths forward. This is a story at its sort of fundamental level about how four hydrocarbon revolutions transformed America in the 19th and 20th century, while at the same time obscuring the reality that our constitutional system was really aging poorly. So let me begin by suggesting that American political history can be broken into or divided into four different ages, each of which began with a major realignment election in 1788, 1860, 1932, and 2008. Each of these contests saw a new political coalition characterized by its own generational, sectional, and racial arrangements come to power. These political ages each began with a progressive cycle that saw significant changes in the types of policy interventions the federal government pursued. Within each of these larger political ages, there were also some minor realignment elections in 1800, 1828, 1896, 1920, 1968, and 1980. These contests either saw a fundamental shift in the nature of the existing progressive cycle or the beginning of a new conservative cycle. And these conservative cycles were particularly important because they saw a structural backlash against the provision of certain types of governmental programs. These cycles created the preconditions as well for the next major realignment election and the inauguration of a new political age. And so the ages run roughly from 1789 to 1860, 1861 to 1932, 1933 to 2008. And I speculate in the book that a new political age started in 2009 after the election of Barack Obama. Each of the political ages was really underpinned by an economic expansion made possible by the leveraging of a new type of non-animal energy. And so this is where the connection between my interest in energy and climate policy really coincides with the political history of the country. The first political age saw the rise to prominence of water power and wood-fired steam engines. The second age was characterized by the exploitation of America's massive coal reserves. And the third age was likewise defined by the arrival of oil and later gas within the energy landscape. This seemingly boundless fossil fuel wealth was leveraged to power what I call the four hydrocarbon revolutions: industrial, transportation, electrification, and agricultural. Combined, they allowed us, the United States, to massively expand the size of our economy. This in turn provided more than enough fiscal resources for our government to provide the American people with unprecedented levels of national and economic security. And so one of the things you'll notice as I talk today is that I'm going to be talking about security in a slightly different way. I'm not going to limit it just to sort of national security, which is the standard way a lot of people talk about it, but I'm going to add at least two other types of security, economic and environmental security, into my discussion. And I'm going to really break economic security into two different types of security, macroeconomic and microeconomic security. During the first political age, from 1789 until 1860, national security was the agreed upon focus of the government. And this was happening as wood-fired steam engines and water power became the key sources or energy sources driving the economy. Support for a government role in providing macroeconomic security during this period of time represented the critical difference between the political parties. And so this ranged from everything from the first and second banks of the United States to internal improvements, or what today we would call infrastructure developments. This helped shape the early development of the American system of manufactures, how the first industrial revolution came to America, and the explosive growth of early railroads using wood-fired steam engines. While still a minor actor economically, the United States was really setting the key foundations that it would see its rise to prominence internationally. The second political age, from 1861 through 1932, saw rapid growth in the use of coal, which paved the way for the formation of the American empire that would begin rising as a geopolitical power kind of at the same time that the United States was taking on macroeconomic security as one of the key responsibilities of government. So it wasn't getting rid of national security, it was adding on a new type of security. This macroeconomic security included such policies as protective tariffs, building key infrastructures, funding mass education, and ultimately creating an effective central bank when the Federal Reserve was created. At the same time, support for a government role in providing microeconomic security, particularly during the progressive era, was the key dividing line between the political parties. This period saw America come to dominate the second industrial revolution, which was focused on steel production and later on mass-produced consumer goods, dramatically expand its national railroad system, had essentially more or a bigger railroad network than the rest of the world combined, gave birth to the commercial electric power industry, which fundamentally reshaped how people lived and worked in the United States, and found some of, and saw the American companies found some of the first successful commercial airlines. As a result, America became the dominant economic player on the planet, surpassing the British Empire to hold that title. Then during the third political age from 1933 to 2008, American exploitation and reliance on oil shaped economic growth, with the government taking on the responsibility for providing microeconomic security, or at least some portions of microeconomic security. And so this included programs ranging from Social Security to unemployment insurance and Medicare and Medicaid. At the same time, we were again adding on to the existing precedents that macroeconomic security and national security had already had. So we were providing three different types of security to the American people: national security, macroeconomic security, and microeconomic security, all at the same time. And this was really something unprecedented in human history. And it was something that was made possible not because of the genius of our political system, but because we had an enormous amount of hydrocarbon energy available. And we had a business sector, at the very least, that was able to leverage that better than pretty much anywhere else on the planet. Later in this political age, support for a government role in providing environmental security came to represent a critical party difference. Although in reality, this paled in comparison to the backlash to the successful civil rights movement and the arrival of the culture wars that have come to define and dominate our modern politics. This period from 1932 to 2008 saw the electrification of rural America, an explosion in highway construction starting in the 1930s and really picking up speed in the 1950s, the continued growth of commercial airline services, the American leadership of the second agricultural revolution, which is sometimes known as the Green Revolution, which was almost entirely fueled by hydrocarbons in one way or another, and domination of the early phases of the third industrial revolution, which we sometimes call the information age. These developments allow the United States to maintain and build upon its status as the world's most important economy. The key point to take away from this capsule history is that energy security provided by our massive reserves of hydrocarbons and leveraged within these four revolutions, the industrial, transportation, electrification, and agricultural revolutions, translated into enormous national wealth. In turn, this really made it incredibly easy to govern the United States, despite the shortcomings of our constitutional structure. Government could provide new and expensive forms of security without requiring significant sacrifices from the American people. But even as America rose to international prominence, both economically and geopolitically, these constitutional flaws were apparent to anyone interested in solving the most serious problems facing the nation during the 19th and 20th century, namely slavery and Southern apartheid. While it was easy to find compromises in other areas, our constitutional system proved inadequate to deliver justice to millions of Americans that had been consigned to brutal subjugation. This mostly hidden reality foreshadowed potential doom for an American nation that no longer enjoyed limitless energy security. That leads me kind of to the second part of my talk, which is going to be focused on what happened when we did actually lose our relative energy security. And this really began in 1970 with the peaking of our domestic oil supplies. We have never produced as much oil as we did in 1970, although we are producing more oil today than we were 10 or 15 years ago. And I'll come back to that later in my talk. But the fact that we no longer had massive domestic oil supplies meant that in the 1970s, we had to seek out other avenues for bringing oil to fuel the American economy. And that led to a lot of different things, but in particular, it led to us spending on average between 1970 and 2020, about $500 billion annually to secure imported oil supplies. Interestingly, most of our oil doesn't come from the Middle East. It mostly comes from the Americas, from Canada, from Mexico, from Venezuela. But we spent most of the money actually protecting the free flow of energy and oil in particular out of the Middle East, because it benefited our economy to keep the global oil price low. And the way to do that was to maintain some level of stability in the Middle East. Of course, that led to all kinds of other problems with regard to the rise of terrorism in the region. And perhaps I'm not going to talk too much about that in my talk, but if people want to ask questions about that later on, I'm happy to talk about that. At the same time that we were losing our energy security and we're all of a sudden having to pay a lot of money to protect oil supplies, there was an extreme conservative backlash that was a reaction to three things, really. First, the New Deal programs that had been passed by the Roosevelt administration in the 1930s and 1940s, the Great Society programs that had been passed by Lyndon Johnson's administration during the 1960s, and probably most importantly, again, the successful passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And these really did lead to sort of an extreme conservative backlash against those programs. And a lot of that was focused on sort of the racial dynamics that had been hidden before and had been allowed to be hidden to some degree because of the energy security that kind of hid what was really going on under the surface. And so what I think that really revealed was that there were significant flaws within our constitutional system. The Constitution seemed to work fine when we were flush with a lot of energy wealth. But as soon as that was thrown into doubt and all of a sudden we really had to be paying a significant amount of our GDP to secure those energy supplies, the constitutional flaws came to the fore very quickly. And that led to the massive political dysfunction that I think began during the 1980s and has been growing worse every year since that time. And so what are these constitutional flaws? It's worth maybe taking a pause and talking about them really quickly. First, I would just say that the Constitution has far too many veto points, places where progress can be stopped. The ability to sort of identify national problems and find solutions to those problems is dramatically harder under the U.S. Constitution with the separation of powers system that's in place. That might have made sense in the 18th century world, where the United States was a quite small country on the fringes of kind of the advanced world, and there were real benefits to a go slow approach. It's also worth saying that the United States government at the time was incredibly tiny. That's no longer true in the 21st century. We are the most important, arguably, country in the world. We have a massive economy, and the federal government does a lot of things within that economy. And we are faced with an incredibly intense international competition where having a lot of veto points makes it very difficult for interested politicians to identify problems that are facing society and quickly react and find solutions to those problems. We have add on to that the fact that the Constitution is actually incredibly undemocratic. We, of course, were all raised, I certainly was, on the idea that the U.S. Constitution was a work of pure genius, and it's attained pretty much mythological status within the American electorate. I remember back when I was, going to school through my K through 12 education, the reverence with which the Constitution was discussed. And of course, it was a quite revolutionary and incredibly democratic document when it was first written and ratified in the 1780s and 1790s. But that was a long time ago. And as I said earlier, it's aged incredibly poorly. And in particular, it has not kept up with the times with regard to actually providing a voice to all of the American people within our governmental structure. And so just to give a couple of examples, the Senate is largely considered by most political scientists to be the most undemocratic legislative institution in the advanced world. So the people of Wyoming have an extraordinarily large amount of power, despite the fact that it's a quite tiny state from a population perspective. And people living in large states like California, Texas, Florida, New York have a relatively limited ability, with only two senators and equal representation in the Senate, to actually bring about big changes. The House of Representatives is actually only slightly better. We have the idea that it is more democratic, and certainly it's more democratic than the Senate, but it really significantly privileges rural voters, the way that single-member districts are instituted within our structure. Means that the vast majority of Americans, something like 80% of all Americans, live in urban areas today, but they have actually much less representation in Congress as a result of the way that we apportion the 435 seats within the House of Representatives. The Electoral College disenfranchises voters in all kinds of different ways. Most obviously, it gives small states three times the amount of power within the electoral system as big states. But quite frankly, even those small states are disenfranchised because most of them, and actually most of the big states, aren't particularly competitive in presidential elections. We have come to a place where 8 or 10 or 12 states are actually competitive in any given election, which means that presidential candidates largely ignore the other 38. And so it's not that the people in those states aren't getting to vote, but their issues aren't really being addressed by our politicians. And finally, we have a situation where the Supreme Court, the sort of third branch of government, has become incredibly partisan in recent years. And that's troubling in one, I think, particular area, which is the ability of the Supreme Court to overrule legislative bills, despite the fact that they oftentimes are supported by a majority of the people on purely constitutional grounds. The final thing worth mentioning is that we have the most difficult written constitution in the world to amend. It's almost impossible to amend the U.S. Constitution, despite the fact that if you ask the American people about some fairly common sense adjustments to how we govern the United States, they probably would overwhelmingly be in support of that. What this results in is a system that political scientists sometimes call a vetocracy, where basically it's very easy for an interested minority to stop all government action that they are opposed to. And I would argue that basically that's what we've experienced in the United States for most of the last 40 years, is minority rule by a small group of what I would call Wall Street Republicans, who have joined with economic libertarians and social conservatives to basically be able to win within these undemocratic legislative and executive institutions. But most of what they're intending to do once elected is to stop all activity towards solving societal problems. Well, what has that led to? What is this rising political dysfunction because of these flaws in the Constitution led to? It's led to a lot of the things that really challenge the United States today. So I would argue that the combination of energy insecurity and the extreme conservative backlash has led to the financialization of the American economic system. And so basically we went from a situation where the financial sector was a very small part of our overall economy to today, where it represents somewhere between 20 and 25% of our economy. And the real result of that financialization is that we've had an incredible increase in income and wealth inequality in the United States. So if you go back to the 30 years after the Second World War, a period that's sometimes called the Great Compression, the average American worker was being led by an executive that was only making about 30 times what they were making. Well, that's now 600, 700, 800 times more in today's world. And I would say that these things are all connected, that basically the ability of the this interested minority to take advantage of the situation of energy insecurity in the nation paved the way for this financialization and paved the way for this disparity in income and wealth inequality, which in particularly hurts brown and black members of our political community. Energy security and the extreme conservative backlash also led to massive educational inequity within the United States. And so it's not too hard to see what this looks like if you're a young kid growing up in a poor state, in a poor school district. You're probably not getting a very good education. And if you're growing up in a relatively wealthy state like Massachusetts or Minnesota, and you're living in a wealthy school district, you're probably getting a first-rate education. And, you know, again, why is that possible, given that almost always education is listed as one of the top priorities by Americans? And the real reason is because the interested minority is able to veto any real reforms that would try to bring more equity into our educational system. Another big issue, and this is front and center before the American people right now, is that energy security plus the fiscal constraints that it put on the federal budget, again, depending on how you count, on average, about $500 billion in costs per year, led to the political dysfunction that we see today and saw the decay of our overall national infrastructure. This is roads, bridges, sewer systems, water systems. And just as importantly, perhaps, as we talk about the climate crisis, it's the construction or paying for new types of infrastructure that are really necessary to battle against what we're facing with that crisis. This definitely second to last point really harkens back to the three sessions from the morning, if people were able to sit in on those. Which is that energy insecurity and rising political dysfunction has led to deteriorating international prestige for the United States. So whereas the United States at the beginning of this era was still considered to be the legitimate leader of the free world. That's anything but clear today, because we simply aren't a very good example of how to run a modern liberal democracy anymore. And then finally, bringing it back to my area of research and what I was really most interested in, is this idea that the conservative backlash plus the political dysfunction led to the continuation of massive hydrocarbon use, despite the fact that scientists were telling us, and in most cases, a majority of Americans were suggesting that reducing our overall greenhouse gas emissions was important to preserving the future of our planet and humanity's place within it. And so that continued hydrocarbon use sort of led to the climate crisis that we're facing today, and it, you know, represents an incredibly large challenge moving forward. And so where does that leave us? What should happen next? How do we get out of this? Well, the first thing to say is that whereas starting in 1970, our relative energy security took a big hit, and we were spending quite a bit of money every year to maintain the free flow of oil out of the Middle East in particular, that's really not the case anymore. Energy security has really returned in the United States. We just seem to have kind of not noticed. We have figured out how to bring or produce a lot of oil and gas through technologies like fracking. And I'm not suggesting that we should be doing a lot of that, but the reality is that we have that technology available now, particularly in gas, that might provide a useful bridge fuel to get us from sort of the dirty economy that we've been living with for the last several hundred years to the clean economy that's required to really win the climate battle. But in addition to that, we have all kinds of new alternative energy sources, whether that be nuclear power, most importantly, wind power and solar power, but also other types of alternative energies from ranging from geothermal to hydropower. And so really, if you look at the full suite of what we have available to us today, energy security really isn't a problem anymore. We're kind of awash in energy right now. But again, I think that we as an American people haven't really recognized that that provides us with a lot of latitude to really solve some of the really key problems that are facing the United States today. And the big question is, how do we use it? The thing that I really came to in writing Hydrocarbon Nation, and also in the process of writing the book I'm working on right now, which is entitled The United City States of America, is that structural reforms really have to be at the forefront of our national agenda. Going back to the original question that I was trying to ask in my talk, why hadn't we taken the climate crisis more seriously? Really, the reason is that we have this constitutional system that is failing to translate the public will into actual public policy. And that's because of the vetocracy that has built up, taking advantage of, again, what I would suggest are these fundamental flaws within the constitutional structure. And so if I, you know, was to suggest anything that really is necessary within our political life today, and this is me saying, you know, coming to you as a policy scientist, not as a political scientist, I really think that what we need is a movement that is going to put structural reforms at the forefront of the national agenda. We're beginning to see that a little bit within the Democratic Party, at least, where younger members of both the House and the Senate, even some of the younger folks that ran for president in 2020, really were talking about structural reforms. But it's certainly not enough yet. It's not normalized enough yet to sort of take off our blinders, stop revering our Constitution so much, a document that was written, you know, more than two centuries ago by a bunch of white men who are long dead, and really looking to what types of governmental structures would best serve the American people today, and again, translate what their concerns are, what they view the major problems facing the nation are, into real and tangible policy actions. And so what are the ways in which we might restructure our system of government? Well, first, and this is has been before Congress since the beginning of the Biden administration, and actually well before that, is the dramatic expansion of voting rights in the United States. Really, we have reached a situation, and it's gotten worse in the last several years, where millions of Americans who should be eligible to vote have been stripped of their voting rights. And we should, at the same time that we're restoring those voting rights, that we're essentially automatically registering anybody who's eligible to vote, we should be doing things that would make it easier for people to vote. So dramatically expanding the accessibility of vote by mail, having Election Day be a national holiday, just to name a few of the things that we probably should be doing. One of the things I want to point out about this is that none of this requires a constitutional amendment. And most of what I'm going to talk about today doesn't require a constitutional amendment. This is important because, again, we have a very undemocratic amendment process that makes it almost impossible, given the divided government, the partisan government that we are faced with today, for them to even debate, much less pass, constitutional amendments that are going to lead to real reform. And so we need to find ways with bare majorities that we can really transform the structures of government. Now, eventually, the hope is that by making our system more democratic, that the chances of really fundamental restructuring might be possible. So yeah, vastly expanding the voting rights doesn't really require a constitutional amendment. You can do that through legislation. Of course, we're faced right now with the reality of the filibuster, and that a few Democratic senators are unwilling to get rid of this vestige of slave power, really, in order to do the right thing and to re-enfranchise millions of Americans. That's not good. One of the other structural reforms that I'm really in support of, and that I'm in fact writing a book about right now, is increasing the number of states in the United States. And this is not simply adding the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico as states, or breaking up California into a number of different states. I'm talking about a really significant increase in the number of states. We have this incredible mismatch between the power that different states have within the federal government, and particularly within the Senate. And what that has led to is a situation where, again, the vast majority of Americans who live in urban areas are just not represented within the federal government in this vitocracy where the Senate basically can veto all action. And one of the few ways that you can get around that is by increasing the number of states, breaking apart a lot of the big states, California, Texas, Florida, New York. So I'm not just talking about breaking up a bunch of you know, Democratic states that will benefit the Democrats, or vice versa, doing it for a lot of Republican states. I think we need to break up all of these states into smaller subsets so that we can have a Senate that is more proportional and actually represents the American people a great deal better. In addition to that, as I suggested earlier, there's a fairly significant rural bias in the way we draw House districts in the United States. And we're, you know, we just had a census, and we're about to have the redrawing of congressional maps all around the country. And even if, the system was to work as best as we can imagine, if there's very little partisanship in it, it would still dramatically overcount rural voters and undercount urban voters. And so I think that there's a real need to increase the number of House districts in the United States. I would recommend probably tripling the number of House districts, getting to something closer to about 1,200 House districts in the United States. And the reason for doing that, one reason is that the average member of the House of Representatives now represents about 800,000 people. It's really impossible to see how they can do that very well. But more importantly, it allows us to create multi-member House districts. And that's important because it'll allow the voters to really get the kind of representation that they want. One of the potential outcomes or even probable outcomes of that is that it would do away with what I think is a really destructive two-party system in the United States and allow for the creation of more political parties. I think we would probably very quickly see a situation where there were five or six different political parties in the United States. And the reason that we don't have that today is largely because of the single member House districts and the incentives that that provides to political parties to co-opt the ideas of other political parties. We're really an outlier amongst the advanced nations of the world in having this type of legislative system and not having multi-member House districts that allow more political parties to exist and really allow the voters to pick the types of leaders that they want based on specific types of issue platforms. Finally, I think we need to eliminate the Electoral College. That's probably easier said than done because while you can try to find ways to get around the Electoral College without a constitutional amendment, they're actually really hard to achieve. The Electoral College we need to get rid of for a variety of reasons. Probably the most important is, again, that it reinforces this idea of a two-party system in the United States, which makes it very difficult to actually represent the American people to be as democratic as possible. I actually think that there are some interesting ways in which you could make a legal argument that the Electoral College is actually a violation of the one person, one vote principle that was established by the Supreme Court in the 1960s. But we would have to have a Supreme Court that was really willing to go forward based on that idea. And so let me conclude by saying that why do I think that this type of more representative government, more democratic government would be important? And it's largely because it would again allow us to tackle big problems in the United States. There are a lot of problems that we're facing right now. I would just point to two in particular that I think that would be easier to deal with. First, income and wealth inequality, which I think is at the root of almost everything that's going wrong with the United States today. And then finally, again, the issue that I think is really an existential threat to not just the United States, but all of humanity, the climate crisis. And so in order to really find enduring solutions to those intractable problems, we really need to look at structural reforms. In conclusion, really, we need to take advantage of the return of energy security to reform these systems and again, translate the ideas or the policy preferences of the American people into actual action. So thank you. I think I went a little over time. I apologize for that, Richard.